So once again, a very, very warm welcome, everybody, a very warm welcome, and especially if this is your first night here on Tuesday at Sangha Night. So if you weren't here last week, I just better give a bit of a recap. In our Sangha Nights, we run a theme normally for 3 months. And in this series of Sangha Nights that started last week, we're going to be exploring a very rich set of traditional Buddhist symbols called the Mandala of the Five Buddhas, or the Mandala of the Five Jinnas. Jinnas means conquerors. So we won't be looking at a conceptual list like the Eightfold Path or the 37 factors of enlightenment. Don't ask me to say that. We'll be using a set of images, archetypal images, as our framework. So exploring how engaging with this, the different aspects of this very rich set of images, set of symbols, can help us in our practice of the Dharma, how it can deepen and enrich our practice and our whole approach to life, and maybe move it to a new level. That's what we're going to be looking at. So as I say, we won't be basing our exploration mainly on we won't be using a framework of words and ideas. We're going to be using a set of archetypal images as our framework. But if that seems like completely alien to you and you're about to run out the door, please don't panic. Please don't panic, because we will also be translating. It's very difficult to give a talk without using words and ideas. So we will actually be translating these images into words and ideas. And the Dharma teachings that are associated with the figures that we'll be exploring. And we'll also be looking at how all of this is relevant to our daily life. It's not just a sort of academic interest. And last week, Bodhinaga introduced the theme and explained a bit about, I suppose, the origins of this mandala and this whole style of practice. He pointed out that we can't really conceive what enlightenment would be like from our current unenlightened state. And there's a real danger that we sort of bring it down to our level. So we imagine me being enlightened as being like me, but just a little bit kinder, a little bit calmer, a little bit more sussed, which is not very exciting, actually. Not very motivating. We need to be excited and motivated. And the Dharma tells us very clearly that enlightenment is not like that. It's not just about being slightly calmer and slightly kinder. It's way beyond anything we can conceive, more wonderful than we can imagine. Supreme bliss, supreme freedom. So it's not that. It's way beyond anything we can conceive from our present unenlightened state. But if we're going to practice the Dharma, if we're going to be aiming for enlightenment, we need some connection to that goal. We need some connection to that goal for the goal we're aiming at. We need to have some feeling for it, or some intuitive sense of what it might be like, some connection to it. We have to have some connection to it, to want to move towards it. So how do we get that? How do we get that if it's beyond our conception? How do we get that? Well, that wasn't a problem. As Bodhinaga said, that wasn't a problem for people in the Buddha's day. They had enlightenment right there, right in front of their faces as they heard about the Dharma. They had an example right in front of them. And it's really obvious from the early scriptures that for those who were receptive, this often had an absolutely electrifying effect on people. They had a direct experience of something that shook them out of their ruts and woke them up for what it was possible for a human being to become. Even in the Buddha's day, his followers couldn't be with him all the time. And they couldn't experience that sort of electrifying wake-up call. And you know, those of his disciples who were living in the Buddha's presence, they would have to live in the Buddha's presence, to live in the presence of enlightenment. Excuse my horticultural analogies. It would have been like keeping a plant in a greenhouse with grow lamps on it. Whereas, I can't help use these analogies because I'm really into growing things, but, whereas very often for us, it's a bit like keeping a plant in our garden in Walkley, which is north facing and 500 feet up and has really stony soil. To live in the Buddha's presence would have just been nurturing. We'd have been drawn towards the beauty of that idea that would have been there all the time for us. But even in the Buddha's day, his followers couldn't all be with him all the time. So even back then, the disciples who couldn't be with the Buddha would meditate on him. They would bear him in mind, keep his positive influence in their thoughts and in their hearts, even when he was miles away, so that it guided the way they lived and the way they thought and the way they felt and the way they spoke. So that was there, even in the Buddha's death, even in the Buddha's life. There's lots of examples of that in the earliest recorded scriptures. Even with the Buddha, it was a very important practice even then, and the Buddha predicted that certain people who made that their main practice, that practice would lead them to enlightenment. Then after the Buddha's death, this practice of the mindfulness of the Buddha, as it came to be called, became even more important, obviously, because nobody could be with the Buddha in body. And it became a really principal practice, I am told, by a great scholar of Buddhism, Edward Conza, in just about every single school of Buddhism. It became a serious practice, a really important practice. This practice of keeping the ideal in the imagination, keeping this connection to another dimension of being, keeping that alive in the mind, letting it light up the mind, light up the feelings, letting it perfume the mind. That became one of the most important meditations and mindfulness practices that people used to do. When we keep the ideal in mind, we're attracted towards it. We are moved by it. And the qualities of enlightenment that we have, as it were, hidden deep down inside us get stirred up and awakened and activated. So it's traditionally said that if we do that practice, our mind comes to dwell on the plane of the Buddhas. Our mind comes to dwell on the plane of the Buddhas. It's also said, I think Bodhinaga said this last week, our mind becomes like a shrine room. So if the Buddha is there in our mind, it's like a shrine room where the Buddha is there at the front, and there's just this atmosphere of calm and positive states, and maybe perfumed with incense. So our mind becomes like a shrine room. So this was a really important practice, meditating on the Buddha, keeping the Buddha in mind, mindfulness of the Buddha. And the Buddha being the primary symbol, archetype of enlightenment. But enlightenment's got so many facets. It's got so many facets. If we're meditating on the Buddha, we could focus on his bright wisdom, or his empathy and kindness, or his strength and courage, or his unshakability in the face of adversity, in the face of the things that happened around him, his creativity. We could focus on the sort of uplifted quality that gave him that sense of almost dwelling in another realm while sort of inhabiting this one, being of in the world but not of it. We could look at all of those different aspects of the Buddha. And one of the things that happened over the years, maybe over the centuries, as people meditated on different aspects of enlightenment, different aspects of the enlightened mind, is that different archetypal figures mysteriously emerged, which embodied these different aspects of enlightenment, embodied sort of constellations of what it meant to be enlightened, aspects of enlightenment. Making it much easier to focus on a sort of almost a simpler idea of enlightenment, one go at a time. and the mandala of the five Buddhas that we're going to be exploring over the next 3 months brings together some of the most important embodiments of aspects of enlightenment that arose. The mandala of the five Buddhas, I sometimes liken it to an exploded diagram of enlightenment. If you look at a sort of car manual, you'll get your sort of picture of your engine, and then it'll be sort of like bits all over the place with arrows going to it and a key. It's a bit like that. It's an exploded diagram of enlightenment. Or maybe better, it's like enlightenment is a white light and it shines through a prism and breaks up into different colours, and the mandala of the five Buddhas shows us the different colours that that white light consists of. So the different, so these different Buddhas embody different aspects of enlightenment, making it much easier for us to get an imaginative connection, perhaps, with those qualities, or maybe not. But it's one way to get a more imaginative connection. And as well as embodying, if you like, aspects of enlightenment, different colours of that white light of enlightenment, the five Buddhas are also seen as traditionally, I'm going to use this word very, very cautiously, having a connection with a particular type of personality. I don't want to sort of give the impression that we're talking about some sort of magazine personality test here, because we're not. But it's different personality types are traditionally seen as having an affinity with one or other different Buddhas of this mandala. And that the Buddha that we have an affinity with can transform negative aspects of that sort of particular personality into something positive, into a positive wisdom. So they're said to have poisons, which they transform into particular wisdoms. And we'll see more about that as we go along. So in a way, each Buddha is not just an aspect of enlightenment. Each Buddha is also a gateway to enlightenment if you're approaching it from a particular direction, as it were. If you're a particular, you've got particular sort of, I hate this word personality type, but a particular sort of nature. Overall, our mandala. A mandala, what is a mandala? A mandala is, one way of looking at it is it's got different aspects, but they're all part of the same thing. They're all the same thing. So we have a mandala of the five Buddhas. And these five Buddhas are seen as each sitting in the four cardinal, there's four of them sitting in the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, and one in the center. The Buddha in the center is white. And his white light is the white light of enlightenment, but it's refracted into these other colors around them. So four Buddhas around a central Buddha. And we could see this mandala as having two separate axes. So one axis being east-west, and one axis being north-south. And you could say that the east-west axis represents more some sort of inner qualities of enlightenment, and the north-south axis more the way enlightenment manifests in the world. That's a simplification, but everything I say is a simplification. So looking first at the east-west axis, the inner axis, if you like, we have two contrasting Buddhas in the east and the west, who we could say, simplifying again, represent the thinking and the feeling aspects of enlightenment. So in the east, sitting in the east, we have the blue Buddha, Akshobhya. Akshobhya, the name means something like unshakable. And you'll notice that he's reaching down and touching the ground. He's in the mudra, the earth-touching mudra, the same as our Buddha on the shrine, which arises from a particular episode around the enlightenment of the Buddha, when the Buddha was sort of challenged by Mara, the manifestation of all that sort of holds us back. What right have you got? And he touched the earth to show, well, I have that right. It's a really powerful gesture, isn't it, of being supported by the earth, groundedness, grounded on the earth. So we could see that as a sort of unshakability. I can't be shaken. I cannot be shaken. I'm grounded on the earth. His name means unshakable. He's touching the earth to show his unshakability. And it's not shown in this picture, I don't think, but There's a whole load of symbolism associated with each of these. Each has got an animal, and his animal is the elephant. And if you ever tried to push an elephant around, you know that they're pretty unshakable. So all of this imagery, all of this, it's all pointing to this unshakability. But more than that, he's blue. And blue, I suppose we generally regard blue as a cool colour. It's quite a cool colour. And his time of day is the dawn. So a time of day that's cool and very, very clear. Very cool and clear. And his season is the... I'm not sure about this. I might have got that wrong, so I'm not going to say it. Anyway, his season is the dawn. Time of day is the dawn. So that cool clarity of the dawn. So we've got cool. It's almost like it's the cool thinking aspect of enlightenment. Above the passions, above the sort of stuff that knocks us around. And it's clear. It's clarity of enlightenment. And you'll notice he's got this symbol of a vajra. Now, if you've been around for a while, you'll know what a vajra is. But if you haven't, you may be thinking, what on earth is a vajra? I should say, it's a very traditional symbol in Buddhism. I should say that everything I'm going to say about vajras, the word vajra in modern Indian languages means something quite different. So I'm not going to go there. But in Buddhism, in traditional Buddhism, it means this thing that's there. It's sometimes translated as the diamond thunderbolt. And it's the ultimate weapon, in a way. It's like can be hurled and it smashes through any obstacle. It smashes anything out of its way. It smashes through any obstacle. And it's a diamond thunderbolt. So it's got qualities of a diamond, and it's got qualities of a thunderbolt. So what about diamonds? If you ever look, I don't often do this, but if you ever look into a diamond, especially a nice big one, you'll see this incredible bright clarity, this incredible, precise bright clarity. That's one thing about diamonds. And the other thing about diamonds is that they will cut anything and they cannot be cut. So they'll go through anything. And secondly, a thunderbolt, a lightning flash, bang! So what about lightning flashes? Well, lightning flashes, I mean, if you're out in a dark night and suddenly there's a lightning flash, suddenly everything is clear as day, absolutely shockingly clear. You can see everything, every detail. It illuminates everything, maybe quite harshly. Bright, bright illumination. And secondly, what do thunderbolts do? They wake us up. Suddenly we're sort of out of our sleepy state. Wakes us up not always gently. It's frightening. Thunderbolts are frightening. So it's a diamond thunderbolt. That's what his symbol is. His symbol is a diamond thunderbolt, which has this clarity and sort of destroying obstacles quality to it. It cuts through unclarity. It destroys obstacles. And that's his symbol. And each of these figures is associated with a whole family of other figures. So his family is the Vajra family. They all represent an approach to enlightenment, which is about clarity, about breaking through, cutting through obstacles. He's got some quite frightening members of his family, actually. So the most famous is Vajrapani, and Vajrapani is built like the guy you just do not wish to meet. And he's striding forward, surrounded by flames, holding his Vajra, breaking through any obstacles. So, summing up, Akshobhya, we could say, embodies the cool thinking aspect of enlightenment. His blue colour is cool, his time of day is the cool dawn. Along with this coolness goes clarity and clear seeing. the clarity of dawn, the clarity of a cold, bright winter's day, the clarity of a diamond, the clarity of things seen in a diamond. And his this clear, cool seeing makes him, as it were, immovable, unshakable, above passing events. He sees the big picture. He's imperturbable. He can't be pushed around like an elephant. And blue, well, blue is the colour of the sea and the sky, boundless, boundless, sort of extending. So I always think that this blue sky, this blue imagery is associated with infinity, with distance, that sort of oceanic feeling, the completely free mind of the enlightened being. So, there's something almost a bit fierce about the cool, precise clarity of Akshobhya. And the type of person who's said to have an affinity with Akshobhya maybe is sometimes a bit fierce as well. So as I said, each of these figures transforms a poison into a wisdom. And Akshobhya's poison is, well, it's said to be hatred. Now, hatred is probably a bit too strong, but we might say a tendency to be a bit bad-tempered, a bit irritable, to criticize, to see the faults, maybe be a bit fierce, a bit impatient, a bit critical, a bit cutting. So if we tend to be, if in a discussion we tend to think, well, let's get to the truth, I don't care if it upsets people. If we are a bit impatient with untruth or fuzzy thinking or unclarity, maybe a bit critical, if, like me, you want to throw things at the politicians on the television screen, when they don't answer the question, maybe you have an affinity with Akshobhya. As I've said, he's very associated with the faculty of thinking traditionally, and people who value clear thinking more than they value feeling may have an affinity with Akshobhya. I've heard it said, so you can't criticize me for saying this, I've heard it said that many scholars have an affinity with Akshobhya. That maybe they could be Akshobhya affinity. Maybe they could sometimes be a bit critical and competitive, and bad-tempered even. So you may think, well, do I have an affinity with Akshobhya? But Akshobhya transforms the negative aspects of that personality type. That personality type sees through things. It wants to get to the bottom of things. It's really impatient with anything that gets in the way. It's impatient with fuzz and blah, all that. So there's a real strength there of clear seeing, So Akshobhya is said to transform the poison of hatred, the poison of that sort of person, if you like, into what's called the mirror-like wisdom, the wisdom that just sees things just as they are, just clearly, just as they are. And there is this sort of, like, seeing things in a clear mirror, there is this sort of connection between, if you like, ill will and clearly seeing the faults in things and experiencing the energy of anger, cutting through the fog of inessentials to get to the truth. So there's a sort of connection there. Changes that personality type, or uses the positives of that personality type for wisdom, for clarity of wisdom, the mirror-like wisdom. And then opposite Akshobhya on our mandala, so he's in the east, opposite on the west, we have the contrasting red Buddha, Amitabha. He's warm. He's a warm red color. His name means infinite light. So warm and red, the colour of emotion, the colour of warmth, the colour of love. And his time of day is the sunset, when the world tends to be sort of peaceful and still warm from the day, but not harsh. As I say, his name means infinite light, and his gesture is the meditation mudra. He's sitting in the mudra, the gesture of meditation. We could see him as constantly doing the metta bhavana for all beings, sending infinite light, his name, sending infinite light of metta throughout the universe to all beings. And in contrast to Akshobhya, his symbol is the vajra. Now the lotus. Now you can just see that sort of in the central circle, he's holding up a lotus, which refers to a vision of Amitabha, which Sangharakshita, our founder, had. So he's holding up a lotus. His symbol is the lotus. And the lotus is a sort of tropical water lily. It's very beautiful, but it grows from really smelly mud. So it grows from really smelly mud up through really dirty water, and then it opens into something pristine and pure and very beautiful, which can never be sullied. Any dirt, any droplet of muddy water just leaves it completely. It just always stands there, looking perfectly pure and clean and beautiful, unstained. And so just after his enlightenment, we're told that the Buddha had a vision of humanity as a lake of lotuses. And some of us were like deep in the mud, and some of us were still growing up through the dirty old water, and some of us could maybe see a glimmer of light, and some of us were actually out of the water and not quite open yet. What he'd already decided that he couldn't communicate the content of his enlightenment. It was incommunicable. You couldn't tell people, oh, enlightenment's like this, and they go, oh, okay, I'll do it then. It doesn't work like that. It's like trying to describe the color blue to someone who's always been blind, something like that. You can't do it. He saw that he couldn't just say, well, enlightenment's like this. But what he could do, he couldn't communicate it, but what he could do is help people to grow towards it. So we were growing beings. We could grow towards that state where we would open as lotuses, almost from wherever we were. So this symbol of the lotus compared to the vajra comes to represent a sort of more gentle, gradual growing towards enlightenment rather than breaking through to enlightenment. A more feeling-based approach to enlightenment based on growing and unfolding. And the red warmth of Amitabha is like the nurturing warmth. We grow, plants grow in the warmth. That sort of warm growth towards enlightenment rather than a sort of smashing through. And again, he has a whole family of figures based on who have the lotus as their symbol, the Padma family. And they're, of course, quite different from the figures in the Vajra family. They represent this more gradual, gentler, growth-based approach. So these two approaches to enlightenment are often sort of contrasted. Obviously, we need a bit of both, which I think is brought out very nicely in the name of our president, who is called Padma Vajra. So, you know, you've got both of them. Yeah. But we may nonetheless have a bit of an affinity more for one than the other. So it's traditionally said that if we tend to value feeling above thinking, if we value harmony above clarity, whereas the Akshobhya person might want to get to the bottom of the truth, it doesn't matter who it upsets, if in a discussion we're more concerned, well, let's keep everybody happy, and you know, a bit of fuzz and fog doesn't matter. If we're maybe a bit greedy for pleasure, food, sex, comfort, maybe if we're even a bit addictive, we may have an affinity with Amitabha. It's about liking. It's about it's sort of the wanting to drag towards rather than wanting to push away. Attraction rather than aversion. And Amitabha transforms the potentially negative aspects of that, greed, lust, sticky possessiveness, etc., addictiveness, into what's traditionally called the discriminating wisdom. We have to be, really think about what the word discriminating means. That discriminating means seeing the difference between one thing and another. It tends to have very negative associations for a lot of people because it's used to mean discriminating on grounds on which you shouldn't discriminate. But that's all it means. It means seeing the difference between one thing and another. Maybe it'd be better to call it the wisdom of particularity. It's the wisdom that sees each individual thing in its unique individuality and loves it for its unique individuality, without wanting to own it or possess it or consume it or have sex with it or anything else like that. It's a completely, just loving it for itself, loving it for itself, seeing its unique individuality and loving it for itself. So that's what that sort of wanting type, wanting to eat, own, etc., can be transformed into. It's said that it transforms the poison of greed into the discriminating wisdom, or the wisdom of particularity, the thing that loves each thing for itself. So that's a bit about the north-south axis of our... the east-west axis of our mandala. In the north-south aspect, I'm going to suggest, although this is again a generalization, that this represents more the outer aspects of enlightenment, how enlightenment might manifest in the world, or how we might manifest in the world. So in the north, we have the green Buddha, Amoghasiddhi. Amoghasiddhi means, the name Amoghasiddhi means something like unstoppable success. Unstoppable success. And he's green. And green in Buddhism is the colour of action. It's the colour of action. He's not shown this way in this, but in some traditional representations, he's carried round the world, as it were, he's carried on the back of these, his throne is carried by these birds that are sometimes called Shang Shang birds, who are crashing cymbals. So he's not a very calm Buddha. You can imagine it. Crash! Dashing through the world. Unstoppable success. And his gesture is the gesture of fearlessness. Gesture of granting fearlessness. So he represents, if you like, the unstoppable action of the enlightened being, who is freed from all fears, freed from all limiting anxieties, freed from all limiting neuroses, freed from lack of confidence and limiting beliefs. All the things that stop us being effective in the world. And might notice his symbol is a vajra. His symbol is, but it's a crossed vajra. And so we've seen that vajras maybe represent energy. They maybe symbolize energy, that sort of energy of breaking through. Well, a crossed vajra, I think, is quite a powerful symbol of integrated energy. Energies that are unified, combined. They're not pulling in every different direction. And of course, that's the key to unstoppable success in a way, is that that sort of integration, having our energies united, integrated, flowing in the same direction, not pulling us in loads and loads of different directions. Amoghasiddhi is said to transform the poison of envy. I always struggle with this. I don't quite get this one. But I think I'm going to suggest that what this is about is that those of us who are not so successful ourselves, so he's unstoppable success, but those of us who are not so successful ourselves, who are maybe held back by fear, by anxiety, by lack of confidence, by limiting beliefs about ourselves, that we may tend to resent others who shine and are successful. So that envy may come in on the back of lack of success, the things that stop us being successful, leading to envy. So if we need to be transformed, so if that's us, if we feel that, yeah, I do limit myself, I don't do things because I fear I might fail at them. I don't do things because I think I'm not good enough. I don't do things out of fear or anxiety. And maybe I have a little bit of a resentment to those that do and those that take leadership roles, a bit of envy, then maybe we have this affinity with Omega City. And maybe we need that fearlessness of Omega City to be more successful, to leave some of those things behind. So... that's a little bit about Omega City. Then the fourth Buddha that we're going to look at, which is who is in the south, is the Buddha Ratnasambhava. And Ratnasambhava means, the name means born from a jewel, born from a jewel. And he's golden, he's the golden colour of sunshine, of riches, gold. It's the golden colour of gold. The sunshine that ripens the crops and enriches the world. and his season is the productive and generous summer. We've got a lot of symbolism in this particular picture of that, of things flowering, etc., etc. So, his name means born from a jewel. And, of course, his symbol is a jewel. That's a jewel which he is holding. That's a stylized jewel which he is holding in his hand. the jewel is his symbol. Again, of course, a symbol of wealth, a symbol of abundance and wealth. And he's holding his hand in a gesture that we often see, perhaps, in Buddhist figures, which is the gesture of giving. A gesture of generosity, holding the hand out to give to the world. So if you like, he represents the creative, enriching, generous aspect of enlightenment that gives, that makes a gift of itself to the world, that gives its gifts to the world, enriches the world, giving its gifts and its talents to the world. So we could say that, if you like, he's the Buddha of the gifted, the successful, the creative, people who have much to give, many talents, many gifts, much to give. But such people may be prone to pride. And of course, pride is the poison which he transforms. Such people may be prone to treating their gifts as a personal achievement. Perhaps they've been put in a very privileged position, but it's because I'm so wonderful. So if we see their gifts as something that we own, that we should use for our own profit, our own success, that make us better than others, that others should look up to us, if we secretly think we're a little bit above others, then maybe we have an affinity with Ratnasambhava. And he transforms this poison of pride into the wisdom of sameness, the wisdom that sees that we are all essentially the same, in a way that's a contrasting, it's the other side of the wisdom of particularity of Amitabha. On the one hand, everything has this unique quality that we can love it for, but on the other hand, everything, all people are, in a sense, the same. It's not like some of us are so much better than others. We have different gifts, different advantages. We don't own the gifts that have been given to us, as it were. We need to give them to the world rather than use them for our own benefit. So if we feel we're successful and talented, and if maybe we think secretly somewhere we're a little bit better than quite a lot of other people, maybe we need a bit of that wisdom of sameness of Ratnasambhava to transform that. So then at the center of our mandala, those are in the four corners, in the center of our mandala, we have the white Buddha Virochana. His color is white. It's not refracted. And his name means the illuminator. He sits at the center of the mandala like the sun, at the center of the solar system. And his symbol is the wheel of the Dharma, the wheel of truth. And his mudra, his gesture, is the gesture of teaching the Dharma. if Akshobhya transforms hate and Amitabha transforms greed, there's one missing of the famous trio, which sits at the center of the wheel of life, which is delusion. And I think we can say that what Virochana transforms is delusion. He does that through the wisdom of the Dharma, through the wisdom of the Dharma. So if maybe we aren't so prone to anger or greed, but if we just tend to feel a bit confused about everything, a bit spaced out, a bit not sure about what the dickens is going on, or what we should do in a fog, we may have an affinity with Akshobhya, with Virochana. So he transforms this delusion and ignorance into the all-encompassing wisdom of the Dhammadhatu. It's like if we're in that sort of state, we need structure. We need the right view of the Dharma. We need a structure that really works, that can guide our thinking and free us from all the sort of competing views and ideologies that we're bombarded with, which can just put us into a state of total confusion all the time. So many views in the world. So that's at the center of the mandala. We're going to hear more about all of these figures, incidentally, and some of the other figures associated with them, and some of the teachings that we may need to bring these transformations about as we go along. But that's a bit of an introduction to the mandala. So what are these figures? What are they? Last week, I think it's fair to say that the main emphasis that Bodhinaga put on it last week is that these are sort of aspects of the historical Buddha. We can link all of these back to the historical Buddha. That's a perfectly valid way of seeing it. But somehow, they are not just symbols. They are not just symbols of bits of the Buddha. That wouldn't be very exciting at all, would it? I can only go on people's experience. My own experience is that it's possible to connect with these figures as a present time reality, that they're really there. They have a real existence. This week, what I said, some of it could be interpreted as sort of the five Buddha mandalas, a sort of dharmic personality test. Well, that's not right. That's not right at all. That element maybe is also there in the tradition, but they're much more than that. They're aspects of the enlightened mind, and the enlightened mind can manifest it to us any way it jolly well pleases. It's trying to get through to us. We could almost say they're aspects of reality. Now, potentials with that. We could either say they're aspects of reality out there trying to get through to us, or they're potentials within ourselves. You might like one of those better than the other. I think ultimately the Dharma would say they're saying the same thing because there's no difference between the inside and the outside. But what I'd advise is probably what's best is not to worry too much about that. And just suspend disbelief. Maybe they're a bit beyond what we can understand. Maybe just suspend disbelief and allow our imagination to engage with them and see what happens rather than having to sort of try and put them in a box. So one of these figures may have particularly spoken to you. Yes. And if not, you might just want to, as we end, reflect, you know, do I have more of a affinity with Akshobhya or Amitabha? In a discussion, do I tend to look for truth rather than keeping everybody happy and harmony? Am I a bit critical and impatient? Do I tend to get angry and critical? Or am I a bit too prone to looking for satisfaction from food, sex, drink, drugs, sex? I said that twice. Comfort. So addictive desire, sticky grasping to people, infatuation with people. So do I need to transform that sort of rather ill will, impatient type? Do I need to transform that, use that in to turn it into clarity? Or do I need to transform this rather sort of grasping into this wisdom of particularity, just loving things for themselves without wanting to own them or consume them or anything else? And if I can't decide between those two, maybe I'm a confused, deluded type. If I'm in a bit of a fog, I don't make decisions, maybe I need to transform that rather spaced out state by getting a clear picture of the Dharma, a clear dharmic framework for my thinking and my decisions. So looking at the north-south axis, do I tend to be a bit passive, let others take responsibility, to stop myself, limit myself by from fear, from anxiety, fear of failure, negative self-view, lack of confidence? And then do I tend to resent others who succeed or take the lead? Maybe then I need a Mogga City's fearlessness to break me out of that, to transform that into success. Or do I tend to think rather well of myself? Could I sort of work more to stop using my gifts and talents as a personal possession that makes me better than everybody else, see them as something that's given to me that I should give to the world, so that I'm to see that I'm not really that different from others, to transform that pride into the wisdom of sameness, seeing that we're all in the same boat.